London, a busy kaleidoscopic city filled with people, brimming with life. It is hard when chronicling the story of this place to not allow contemporary events influence what you write, mostly because the London of the past is occasionally filled with many of the same passions and issues that the London of today faces. There are endless attempts to stay on top of crime. There are complaints about how businesses operate. There is coping with bad weather. There are issues with things like food standards and hygiene. There are people making money by deception or cutting corners to avoid regulations. Then, as now, these common themes arise. I suppose it is reassuring. One of the aims of this podcast has been always to highlight the similarities between Londoners over the long passage of history, to identify historical overtures and motifs shared by Londoners in the past as they are by contemporaneous residents. And such shared concerns are important, because the London of the past is an alien place. The very way they conceptualised the world was different to how we conceptualise the world today. Yet, paradoxically, when you find those similarities, they stand out, they demand attention, as they remind us that places can retain a certain temperament of character, and London is clearly one of those places. The character of this city was defined in the past, and the current residents merely fill the space their agency influenced by the ancient nature and demeanour of this metropolis. Hi, my name is Saul, your host and narrator of this, the ongoing story of London. Each week we try and tell the history of the city in manageable chunks, each one taking us a little bit further along in the grand chronological tale of the city and its residents and the events that took place within it. This week we've reached chapter 127, and in terms of time, we're in the first part of the 1360s. The city is emerging from the darkness both of war and of pestilence, but with the second great outbreak of the plague now passing, and the new Treaty of Calais, which brings an apparent end to the decades-long war with the French, London could turn its gaze inwards and try to get back on top of the pressures impacting upon the largest community of residents in England, even if the population had depreciated severely, with two outbreaks of the plague in less than 15 years. Of course, trying to stay on top of such a wild, vibrant city was never going to be easy. And so we have an episode this week dedicated to the actions of the mayors and the civic authorities, as well as the ne'er-do-wells of London, filled with physical threats upon mysterious pet bisons, tubs of wine being poured over rich vintners' heads, wild accusations of murder plots, and dodgy fast food. Welcome then to chapter 127 of the story, The Putrid Pigeons of Billingsgate. In January 1362, severe bad weather impacted upon London. A huge winter storm blew in from the Atlantic and caused massive amounts of damage. The storm apparently damaged, quote, high houses, lofty edifices, towers and belfries, trees and other things, both hardy and durable, with the greatest violence, unquote. We know in this year that the steeple of the newly built Austin Friars blew down, and presumably was during this winter hurricane. How bad was the damage? Well, we get a clue and also an insight into the realities of life in this decade from an ordinance issued by the king in the aftermath of the storm. So the storm hit in January, and by March, we see the king writing, quote, "Whereas we've been given to understand that under pretext of the tempest of wind that has of late unhappily occurred in diverse parts of our realm, by reasons thereof, many buildings have been levelled with the ground, and many dilapidated, broken and damaged, and great multitudes of tiles and other coverings have been wholly or for the greater part torn from the roofs thereof," unquote. So that's pretty bad. It sounds like a terrible storm indeed. But King Edward suddenly pivots in this thing he's writing, and he points out, quote, those who have tiles to sell and other things suitable for roofing such houses do sell the same entirely at their own pleasure and at a much higher price than heretofore they were wont to do, and that the tilers and other roofers of buildings, seeing so great an urgency for persons of their calling, hesitate to follow their trade or to do any work unless they receive excessive wages for the same, and in like manner refuse, to the no small loss and grievance of our commonwealth." Unquote. You can almost hear the King's Court's outrage. "What do you mean the prices have gone up?" Once again, in face of market forces, or blatant profiteering, the King refuses to countenance this. And he goes on to state, quote, "We have ordered that tiles and other things requisite for the roofing of buildings shall be sold at the same price which they were used to be sold before the Feast of Our Lady's Nativity last pass, and at no higher rate, and that tilers and their men, or assistants, and all other servants, artificers and workmen shall not take, nor in any way presume to extract for their daily labour, greater stipends or wages than before the said feast they were wont to take." Unquote. Yeah. He was basically banning this profiteering by insisting that all wages and all costs should be the same as they were in the December before the storm hit. And he even included price and wage controls for the people who made the tiles. The entire production chain he forbade from profiteering. No sooner had he said this, the King informed London's mayor and the authorities, quote, "We do command you that all and singular the matters aforesaid you will cause to be publicly proclaimed in the city, as well within the liberties as without, and will cause it on our behalf strictly to be forbidden that anyone shall do aught against the ordinance aforesaid, or dare attempt to, privily or openly, on pain of forfeiting unto us all things he may forfeit. And all those who, after our proclamation and prohibition aforesaid, shall be found doing to the contrary thereof, will take and imprison him without delay, and their goods and chattel, as being forfeit unto us, will arrest and under arrest detain." Unquote. Yep, the King has spoken, and he's not pissing around. Once again, King Edward III was showing he had one foot in the medieval at all times. His reactionary economic policies, trying desperately to add controls onto London, well, this is what he's been doing all along. And we will say profiteering in the face of sudden need is a very London activity. After all, this is the city that, when they got the Olympics, announced that they'd freeze prices to prevent hotels putting up their prices. At least in the last Olympics they did anyway. 1362 went on to see a bevy of controls upon the city, with new ordinances introduced to manage and regulate the trade of dyers and weavers, stating the amount they could charge for their goods. Quote, "Dyers shall dye at the rate of £10 for 8. Unquote. And this carried on into the years that followed. By 1363, however, we come across a city trying to make the most of the new peace that had broken out between them and the rest of Europe. And this year, towards the end of it, one of the loveliest and longest-lasting myths of London began. It is said that Edward III entertained the kings of Scotland, France, Denmark and Cyprus all at the same time. And as part of these celebrations, a feast was held, a banquet, hosted by a former mayor of London, the vintner Henry Pickard. The story is almost certainly a myth, passed down and maintained by many, including, I have to say, the Vintner Livery Company. But it is still remembered today, with the ritual of the vintners toasting not with 3 cheers, but with 5, remembering this feast of 5 kings. Edward III's rules and regulations on prices and foodstuff and the victuals of London was all-consuming. And in 63, we read that the outgoing mayor, Stephen Cavendish, a draper, had decided to introduce quite a few of these. And he decreed that, quote, "The best goose shall be sold for 6p. The best suckling pig for 8p. The best capon, 6p. A hen, 4p. The best rabbit, 4p. A teal, 2.5p. A river mullard, 5p. 4 larks, 1p." Unquote. The list of prices that could be charged for meat to be sold in London was quite extensive, with mandated prices for snipes and partridges and woodcocks. It would say the price of a shoulder of roast mutton would be 2.5 pence, whereas a full carcass would be 2 shillings and more. These rules were simple. Meat was to be sold in the city, quote, at a reasonable price, according to its value, unquote. During this decade, London does feel less like a metropolitan town and more like a budget supermarket. Now, we assume these set prices was annoying the victuallers of London, however, and they would occasionally keep stuff under the counter, shall we say, so that when their product was all sold out, if anyone was desperate, they would arrange a secret sale during which prices were raised. And why do we say this? Well, Mayor Cavendish's rules also go on to state, quote, that no victualler, of whatsoever condition he be, shall conceal his victuals which he has to sell, on pain of paying the first time 0.5 mark to the chamber and of being put in the pillory the second time, unquote. And as well as that, his rules state that, quote, no victualler shall withhold any manner of victuals until they've become corrupt and stinking. And if anyone shall do so, and be convicted hereof, let the same victualler in whose hands such spoilt and stinking victuals shall be found, be taken and put on the pillory, and the said stinking and spoilt victuals shall be burnt beneath him, unquote. No upcycling your food, you rotten stinking gits. This regulation was, as we will see this episode, to be put to a test within a few years. Food regulations continue to dominate the records this year because nestled next to a record of a man from Westminster called Henry Forsays buying from somebody in Cambridge jewellery that belonged to the late Bishop of London to give to a spicer in London, we also read there was an incident concerning what appears to be a farmer from Kent. We read that, quote, on the 9th day of the month of November, William Coke was taken because on that same day, he, the same William, carrying a sample of wheat in his hand in the market within Newgate in London, followed one William, a servant of Robert de Lundy, a goldsmith, who wanted to buy wheat from sack to sack, and said that such wheat as he would not be able to buy at a lower price than 21 pence. Whereas on the same day, at the same hour, the same servant could have bought such wheat for 18 pence, unquote. The farmer was questioned and he acknowledged he'd done this to enhance the price of wheat and was condemned to be punished in the pillory. You'll notice the pillory appears quite a lot in this episode. London in 1363 was a place where the professions were transforming into what we would now recognise as the early livery companies of London, the early guilds. And this is the year the Vintners' Company date their creation from. And we get an insight into the continuing wealth of these groups, even with all that was going on economically, from the list of presents made by prominent London citizens and organisations to King Edward III that year. Quote, of the tanners without Newgate, 40 shillings. Of the butchers of St. Nicholas, 9 pounds. Of the butchers of the Stokes, 6 pounds. Of the butchers of Eastcheap, 8 pounds. Of 4 dyers, 2 marks. Of Robert and Richard at the Cross, weavers, 1 mark. Of the Wex Chandlers, 40 shillings. Of the tanners without Cripplegate, 31 shillings. Of the pouchmakers, 5 marks. Of 2 cappers, 13 shillings, 4 pence. Of the grocers of the ropery, 100 shillings. Of Thomas the Skivener in Fraidestrett, 0.5 mark. Of Andrew the Pie Baker, 0.5 mark. Of John of the Harp, 0.5 mark. Of John St. Ive and Roger at the Basket, 0.5 mark, unquote. So yeah, there was money being given out there. It is worth noting, one, just how much money the butchers were giving, but also the rather large size of the gift of our friends, the grocers in the ropery, probably referring to the Fraternity of St. Atheline and the businesses on Soper's Lane. They're giving these new grocers 100 shillings, but that's not all they give. Because we read that King Edward III was not the only king getting presents from London residents that year. The records also indicate, quote, presents sent to our Lord the King of France, unquote, which refers to King John III of France, who at this moment in time was a hostage of the English. These records say, quote, in the first place, received from the drapers, 10 marks. Also from the fishmongers, 10 marks. From the mercers, 10 marks. From the grocers, £4, 6 shillings and 8 pence, unquote. So yeah, our grocers are doing very well. We'll come back to them in a future episode. And it's also worth seeing that that year, the pepperer or grocer, John Knott, had become mayor and was overseeing a busy city. But during his term of office, we have hints that all was not well in the city. By 1364, we encountered the events surrounding a tailor called John de Hackford, who testified before Mayor Knott and the alderman in Guildhall, quote, that one Richard Hay, fuller, came to him in the week last past upon Cornhill and asked him he was one who were at the palace at Richmond when the people of the city were with our lord the king. And he answered yes. And then the said Richard asked if he was a tailor and knew of the design which was entertained. And to this John answered that he was a tailor, but as to any design, he knew nothing about it. Whereupon the same Richard said to him that there were 10,000 men in the said city, all of one alliance and of one agreement, that at a certain time, such as should seem to them to be the best, they would all be ready and prepared with their arms to slay all the best people and the great folks and officers of said city, and that, as he had not been warned before, he now gave him warning to be ready and prepared whensoever the cry should be raised, unquote. Now, the accusation that there was a massive conspiracy of thousands of people in London ready to enact an armed uprising against the great and the good was treated very seriously. And we read, quote, on which charge the said Richard was committed to the prison of Newgate, unquote. And the fuller accused of this remained there for about 3 months. Now, that November, Richard Hay was brought out of Newgate and was brought before the new mayor, the Skinner, Adam de Bury, quote, and in the presence of the same John Hackford, was accused of the words aforesaid and was asked how he would acquit himself hereof. And he made answer that he was not guilty of those things aforesaid, and put himself on the people of the country of Cornhill, unquote. Richard Hay demanded a trial by jury, and a jury of the great and good was summoned. They heard the evidence, and at the end of their deliberations, they declared, quote, upon their oath, that the said Richard was in no way guilty of any of the things to them submitted thereupon. And because that the king himself commanded with his own lips that if said information should be found to be false, the same John Hackford should be punished as an example to other such liars. The same John was reprimanded by the mayor and alderman to the prison of Newgate, there to remain until they should be better advised as to their judgment, unquote. By the 6th of November, John Hackford's punishment was agreed upon. Now, Hackford, who can only assume from the records, must have had some kind of grievance with Richard Hay, so as to make up so serious accusation. Well, he faced quite an interesting punishment indeed. Quote, the said John shall remain in prison for a whole year and a day. And the said John within such year shall 4 times have the punishment of the pillory. That is to say, 1 day in each quarter of the year, beginning with the first day of the pillory on the Saturday aforesaid. And in this manner, the said John shall come out of Newgate without hood or girdle, barefoot and unshod, and with a whetstone hung by a chain by his neck and lying on his breast, it being marked with the words, a false liar. And there shall be a pair of trumpets trumpeting before him on his way to the pillory, and then the cause of his punishment shall be solemnly proclaimed. And the said John will remain in the pillory for 3 hours of the day, and from thence be taken back to Newgate in the same manner, there to remain until his punishment shall be completed in the manner aforesaid, unquote. Now, this evokes brilliant images in our head, but the case seems to have caused a considerable amount of upset in the city. As we read during that year, quote, before Adam de Bury, mayor, the alderman, and an immense number of the commonalty in the great hall of the Guildhall assembled, by their common assent it was ordained that if any person shall be convicted of having forsworn himself in any case touching himself, such person shall be committed to the prison of Newgate, and there remain until the hustings next ensuing. at which hustings he's to be taken from the prison to the Guildhall, before the mayor and the alderman there, and he shall stand on a high stool in full husting there before all the people, bareheaded, and the cause of his imprisonment shall be publicly proclaimed as an example to others so offended. He will then be set at liberty. And if any such person shall be convicted twice of the offence, he shall undergo the punishment of the pillory, unquote. Yeah, it does seem to be that London at this time did not like people giving false testimony, which would suggest that, actually, it was a bit more common than the records seem to suggest. The pillory was in heavy use in 1364, because we read of the case of a baker called John Atterwood, who raised the prices of, quote, his own corn in common market on the pavement within Newgate in London, offering for the bushel of wheat 2.5 pence beyond the common price for a bushel of wheat at the same time in the market sold. And also, the same John Atterwood was attached for that, whereas one Robert de Cordode had 2 quarters of wheat for sale in the said market the day and year aforesaid. And John Atterwood, cunningly and by secret words whispering in his ear, fraudulently withdrew the said Robert de Cord out of the common market, and then they went together into the church of the Friars Minors, and in that church the said John bought 2 quarters of wheat at the price of 15.5 pence per bushel, being 2.5 pence over the common selling price at the time, to the great loss and deceit of the common people, unquote. Now, John Atterwood denied the accusation that he was overcharging on the sale of wheat, and he was put on trial, which met with mixed results for him. The jury found him not guilty of selling his own corn at an inflated price, but that he was guilty of, quote, falsely and fraudulently buying the said 2 quarters of wheat off the same Robert Quod in the church aforesaid, he paying 2.5 pence more for each bushel of wheat than the selling price in the same market, in order to create dearness thereby to the grievous damage of the people aforesaid. And they said that the same John Atterwood, immediately after the purchase of said corn, deceitfully so made, returned to the market aforesaid, and there before the common people avowed the purchase of such corn, saying that he could lawfully do the same, unquote. So yeah, the guy basically paid too much to buy for it so he could justify charging too much to the people. Once again, the pillory was used to name and shame somebody who was overcharging for foodstuffs. And it wasn't just inflating the price of wheat that was causing the civic authorities to clamp down on traders this year. That November, we read that, quote, John Rightways and John Penrose, taverners, were attached to make answer in the plea of contempt and trespass, unquote. Apparently, Rightways and Penrose, quote, in the parish of St. Leopard Eastcheap, in their tavern of Walter Doggett there, sold red wine to all who came there, unsound and unwholesome for men, in deceit of the common people, unquote. Now, rather than just take the accusation that they were selling dodgy wine, at face value, the authorities decreed that the wine should be tested, and 4 vintners were summoned to assess the quality of this booze, and they reported, quote, that the said John Rightways was in no way guilty of the sale of the said wine. Therefore, he was to be acquitted thereof. And they said that the same John Penrose was guilty of the sale of such wine, and they wished him to be imprisoned for 1 year and 1 day, unquote. The problem was, jailing a wine merchant or vintner for selling sour wine was not seen as a jailable offence, and so they were asked to come back and come up with something a little bit more reasonable. Quote, the said 4 supervisors came and gave another judgment in the form as follows. They said John Penrose shall drink a draught of the same wine which he sold to the common people, and the remainder of such wine should be poured on the head of the same John, and he shall forswear the calling of a vintner in the city of London forever, unless he can obtain the favour of our Lord the King as to the same, unquote. Now, whereas I love the image of a 14th century wine merchant being forced to drink a draught of the pig's will he was trying to pass off on people, and then having red wine poured all over his head, the real punishment was where they said he had to forswear the calling of a vintner. In other words, he was out. he couldn't trade in wine again unless he got forgiven and permission to by the king. It is worth noting that Penrose, despite this humiliating punishment, was later reinstated, probably by the following February. Mayor Adam de Bury's campaign about the maintenance of food standards continued that year, as we also read that, quote, on the 23rd day of November, Alice, wife of Robert de Custany, acknowledged that she had sold ale in a measure called a quart that was not sealed, and also that in the same measure was put pitch 1.5 inch in debt, and that rosemary was laid upon it so as to look like a bush in the sight of the common people, which measure was assayed by the Standard of London, whereby it was found that 6 such quarts of this would not make 1 proper gallon of ale. And for falsehood and deceit aforesaid, it was adjudged by the mayor and the alderman that the said Alice should undergo the punishment of the pillory for women ordained, and the same false measure was divided into 2 equal parts, one of which was tied to the pillory in sight of the common people, and the other part remained in the chamber of Guildhall, unquote. It's not so much that she was trying to defraud people with a false measure. It's the elaborate nature she took it. If you think about it, this is someone just pouring ale into a quart measuring jar. But the fact they've put pitch in it to make it 1.5 inches shorter and then covered it with rosemary, supposedly to season the ale, but hide the fact that they've actually made the base thicker than it should have been, that's quite a bit of elaborate con work going on there. It does make you wonder just how many of these kind of crimes were going on all around. And when we read in London records often being discovered, was this just the tip of the iceberg? Meanwhile, as an odd little side story in London that year, it should be noted that at some point around now, the king was given the gift of an uri. Now, we don't know exactly what an uri is, and all the records I could see stated that it was some kind of bison, possibly from Africa. Then it was said that 2 men, one called Roger Owery and one called John Wirt, were given the job of looking after the creature for the king. But suddenly out of the blue, the king sends word to London, quote, we have understood that certain persons of the said city, envying the said keepers, do threaten to do them grievous bodily harm and atrociously kill the said beast, unquote. Wait, what? London wants to kill the uri? The king goes on to say, quote, we wishing to preserve the said keepers and beast from injury and grievance, do command you that in the city you do cause public proclamation to be made, and it on our behalf strictly to be forbidden that any person, native or stranger, of whatever condition he may be in, on pain of forfeiting unto us as much as he may forfeit, have the audacity to do any damage, violence, misprison, or grievance upon the said keepers or to the beast, which we have so taken under our protection and especial defence, unquote. No, we don't know why the keepers of the uri or the uri were threatened, but what we can say is certainly don't mess with the king's buffalo. By 1365, we start seeing the regulations begin to spread, and this year we saw one about how Londoners should be spending their free time, with the record saying, quote, every one of the said city, strong in body, at leisure times and holy days, should use in their recreations bows and arrows, or pellets or bolts, and learn and exercise the art of shooting, forbidding all that they do not after any manner apply themselves to the throwing of stones, handball, football, bandy ball, lambuck or cockfighting, nor such other like vain plays which have no profit in them, unquote. Now, usually much is made of the fact that this compulsory training in archery was a big thing, because it's one of the reasons why English archers were feared across Europe. But what I adore most about this is the list of things that were forbidden. Like all such things, it illustrates what was actually going on in London streets, with wild games of street football and handball against tenement walls, mixing with the raucous sounds of crowds cheering cockfights, and even just the noises of a bunch of kids standing around and throwing stones at things. This was London. They liked their games. They also liked fraud, by the looks of things. 1365 gives us a very elaborate example of fraud. The story of a man called John D. Alliford, originally from Surrey. Alliford's case turns up in January, where it's stated that, quote, "The said John went to the prioress of the house of St. Mary at Clerkenwell, bearing a white wand in his hand as a token of his office, and he then told the said prioress that the Archbishop of Canterbury had now become so stricken with old age and afflicted with diverse other infirmities that he could not make visitation in person throughout his province," unquote. Having convinced the prioress that he was a representative of the Archbishop and the Archbishop could not make his occasional visits to come inspect the priory, he then informed her that a whole bunch of important men, not him, would be turning up soon, all formal and official. And then, well, quote, "thereupon he assigned to the said prioress for a certain day or so of their coming. And also, he makes plate, that the same John pretended to be a purveyor of our Lord the King, to take carpenters to the use of the king in order to work on the castle of Windsor without any warranty for the same," unquote. So, this con man John turns up, convinces the prioress that he's a representative of the Archbishop of Canterbury, says the Archbishop's too sick, sets up a formal meeting, comes across all formal, and is trying to take workers working there away with him. And why was he doing all of this? Well, later under cross-examination at his trial, quote, "he was asked by the court for what reason he went to the prioress, so aforesaid, whereupon he said, for the sake of getting some money from her," unquote. The inept conman was found guilty, and guess what? He ended up at the pillory. 1365 also saw a bunch of regulations about London's plumbers. Now, when reading some of the rules and regulations of professions in the city during this period, they can come across as a tad dry. But when you read the rules on the plumbers, now these come across as rules and regulations designed to please people who were endlessly annoying the city authorities. I'll give you an example. Quote, "In the first place, that no one of the trade of plumbers shall meddle with works touching said trade within said city, or take house or apprentices or any workman in the same, if he not be made free of the city," unquote. So the very first rule is, it was only freemen of London, plumbers who had earned enough money to pay their taxes, who were allowed to be practicing plumbers. We suggest there was an awful lot of people living in the suburbs and around in London who were not free, who were practicing this profession, and it was pissing people off. Because we then read that the reason for this rule was, quote, "that so the said trade may not be scandalized, or the commonality damaged and deceived by folks who do not know their trade," unquote. Well, well, well. Cowboy plumbers in London seems to have been a thing in the 14th century. Interesting how things never seem to change, isn't it? The rules remind the plumbers, quote, "that everyone of the trade shall do his work well and lawfully, and shall use lawful weights without any deceit or evil intent against anyone," unquote. And after telling everybody you've got to do your job right and not rip off anybody, it then goes on to say, quote, "that no one for any singular profit shall engross lead coming to the said city for sale to the damage of the commonality, and that no one, himself or by another, shall buy old lead that is on sale or shall be within the said city or without to sell it again to the folks of the said trade and enhance the price of lead to the damage of the commonality," unquote. Yeah, see, apparently, plumbers dealing in the sales of lead does seem to have been a profitable side hustle. Indeed, plumbers finding new ways to make cash seems to have been a thing. Quote, "no one of the said trade shall buy strip lead of the assistance of tilers, laggers or masons, or of women who cannot find warranty for the same. And if anyone shall do so, himself or by a servant, or if by one of them to be found stealing lead, tin or nails in the place where he works, he shall be ousted from the said trade forever at the will and ordinance of the good folks of the such trade," unquote. So yeah, obviously, this rule's in place because this is what people were doing. Cowboy plumbers seem to be half-inching anything not nailed down. In fact, they seem to be half-inching the nails that nail things down. They also come across as a somewhat ruthless profession, as the rules do declare, quote, that no one of the said trade shall oust another from his work undertaken or begun, or shall take away his customers or his employers to his damage by enticement through carpenters, masons, tilers, or other persons, unquote. In the 14th century, plumbers sound like ruthless ne'er-do-wells, mostly up to no good. It's amazing how the profession has changed in the city, don't you think? London was clearly going through a period of more and more regulations. I mean, we see regulations on home baking. We see regulations about the price of oats. We see the regulations about the selling of furred items. We like to think that our society today is oppressive, filled with over-regulation. And you get that term, you know, the one used by people who really wish they were in charge of everyone, but they use it when they realise someone's in charge of them. Not a temper tantrum. What was it? Oh, yeah, nanny state. There are those people who use the term nanny state a lot, suggesting their lives are somewhat overregulated and organised, and when we come up with rules, we're impinging on my freedom. But from the 1360s, we can see that life in London today is remarkably easygoing compared to the regulations of the past. And actually, most of the regulations were created at the time, as always, by someone screwing it up for the rest of them. London was also a place of feuds and vendettas. While today we often recoil in horror at the assaults and attacks over petty things that take place on our streets, this has long been a part of the city. In March 1365, we saw a high-profile such case. The records tell us of, quote, a certain enormous affray in the parish of St. Magnus in the wards of Bridge Street in London, on the 18th day of March, unquote, and during which a very large body of men, quote, William de Strasdean, Robert Little, son of John, Thomas Palmer, Richard Ethine, William Thursway, Geoffrey de Fulham, apprentice of William de Fulham, and Thomas Gaunt, with others unknown, met Giles Pikeman, citizen and fishmonger, in the parish of St. Magnus in Bruges Street, and there by force and arms with swords, knives, staves, and diverse other arms, made assault upon the same Giles, and beat, wounded, and maltreated him against the peace of our Lord the King, so that his life was despaired of, and there left the same Giles half dead, to the great affray of the whole city, unquote. We do not know the full reasons why this big group of men attacked him, but it's worth noting that some of the names, along with Giles's description as a citizen of London, and the fact the whole city was paying attention to this attack, suggests to me that the trigger could have been simply that Giles Pikeman was a legitimate London fishmonger and citizen who complained about or was impeding upon the sale of fish by fishmongers who were not citizens of the city. That seems to what to be going on here, and again, even though we have no direct evidence to say it is so, I do feel that Pikeman had impacted upon the selling of fish using the city's regulatory powers to cause distress and loss of livelihoods for this bunch of non-citizen fishmongers. They responded by beating him up. But that wasn't the real end of it. Remember, what I've just said is pure speculation. And, you know, for all we know, Giles was beaten up for another reason. But Pikeman certainly did have cash and influence. And we know this because by April, this matter had escalated all the way to the king. Edward III on the 28th of April wrote to the mayor of London saying, quote, Giles Pikeman has entreated us, that whereas he is greatly and manifestly in fear for his life and limb, from the threats of the following persons, John Little, Robert Little, John Hall the Black, John Hall of Northfleet, John Halen, Richard Alastair, Thomas Maying, Thomas Follum, John Peckridge, unquote. And he actually goes on to cover 23 men. So as well as the six men who attacked him, stabbed him and almost killed him, Giles fears from his life from another 23, what the original indictment called the other offenders unknown, perhaps. Again, we're not told why damn near 30 men wanted Pikeman killed. We know Thomas Macking was from a family who had been living in Southwark for generations. The whole thing sounds like a close-knit fraternity, maybe based south of the river, and had gotten into a vendetta against his fishmonger. Also worth noting, it mentions all these men, but I'm surprised that 6 men or 30 men attacked this Giles Pikeman and he somehow survived. What if he had other friends? These were the fishmongers of London, and we know from our records, the fishmongers were not afraid to pack weapons and to fight back. Again, we don't know. Well, we do know the king was involved now, and his letter to the mayor was strict. Quote, "We do command you, strictly enjoining, that immediately on seeing these present, you cause the persons aforesaid bodily to appear before you, and to find each of them sufficient surety that they, neither themselves nor by their procuring, will inflict or procure to be inflicted any injury on his body upon the same Giles in any way." Unquote. So yeah, the authorities picked up these men and basically got them to hand over as much money as they could, with the promise that they'll get it back as long as Giles Pikeman's left alone. Sometimes the stories we find at London hint at much more interesting and salacious and greater tales. Alas, the full details are lost to history. If I can ever find out more about the story of Giles Pikeman, I will report it to you. One big story from 1365 that stands out to me the most, however, and the one where I named this episode after, was the true culmination of all these rules and regulations. And that was the case of a man called John Russell. London records state that, quote, "The same John Russell, on the 15th day of September, in Billingsgate, exposed 37 pigeons for sale, putrid, rotten, stinking, and abominable to the human race, to the scandal, contempt, and disgrace of all the city," unquote. Ark Street vendor John Russell was accused of selling very dodgy fast food. And he refuted the accusations, with the record saying, quote, "The same John Russell says that the same pigeons are good and proper for sale to mankind, and he offers to prove the same," unquote. The city decided to call in the experts, and like a 14th century amalgam of MasterChef and the Great British Bake Off, 4 cooks and 2 specialist pie bakers were gathered, quote, "to inspect and examine whether the said pigeons are good and proper or not," unquote. Their verdict, quote, "that the said pigeons are not good or wholesome for mankind, and therefore he is to have judgment of the pillory, and the said pigeons are to be burnt beneath the pillory, and the cause of his punishment is there to be proclaimed," unquote. Yep, that regulation actually came into effect in the case of John Russell, stuck in the stocks, being laughed at, everybody pointing as a bunch of rotten pigeon meat gets burned below him. And then we move into 1366. And while I mentioned it back in chapter 125, this was the year that the ultimate regulation was laid upon London in some ways. A giant clock tower, the brother of one erected at Windsor Castle, was built in Westminster Palace this year. It didn't have a clock face on, but the large structure located on the north side of New Palace Yard was erected by Henry Yeverley and would ring out the hour upon the hour. Time itself was seemingly being regulated now in London. But I'll leave it there. Thanks for listening. Shorter episode than I've done recently, but I quite like that. This is kind of the optimal length for me. Anyway, I'll be back with the story of London next week. We've got Christmas coming up, so there may be some disruption in the production schedules. And I'll let you all know, my regular listeners, and those who are up to date and listen to the new episodes when they drop each week, thank you all for your continued support. It is really appreciated, as well as the kind donations and gestures from those to the Buy Me a Coffee site, which really do help keep the podcast going along. It's much appreciated. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll join me again next week for the next chapter in the story of London. Thanks. Bye.